All right, this is the case of Vera Martin versus American Colloid. And Mr. Michael Simpson appears from Rapid City on behalf of the appellant. And Ms. Shiloh McNally appears on behalf of the appellee. Chief Justice Gilbertson has disqualified himself on this case. And so we have appointed our former Chief Justice, Robert A. Miller, to sit in his place. Mr. Simpson, you may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Mike Simpson. I represent Vera Martin. This is a workers' compensation successive injury case. It is a different animal. It involves the question of whether South Dakota has an interest in this particular workers' compensation case such that my client can bring her claim here in South Dakota. She was injured in Wyoming. She worked in Wyoming. But she lives in South Dakota, and there are some contacts with South Dakota, such as she got her employment application there. She took her employment physical here. All of her doctoring has been done here. And she even was, the employer tried to get her back to work at one of their South Dakota locations after her injury. In these cases, I've cited a United States Supreme Court case called Cardillo, where the courts try to look at what is a legitimate state interest such that a state can take jurisdiction in a case like this. In the Cardillo case, the claimant in that case had worked in the state of Virginia for 3 years before his injury. He was injured in the state of Virginia. Prior to the 3 years, he had worked for this employer in the District of Columbia. He lived in the District of Columbia. He was injured, actually he was killed, and his widow brought a claim in Virginia to start out, and then she brought a claim in the District of Columbia. And the United States Supreme Court was presented with this very question. Is there enough of an interest for this man's widow so that the District of Columbia can assert jurisdiction? He worked in Virginia for 3 years. He was injured there. But his widow lived in the District of Columbia. And the United States Supreme Court held that the District of Columbia had a legitimate interest in providing adequate workers' compensation measures for its residents, which does not turn on the fortuitous circumstance of the place of work or injury. And that's a United States Supreme Court case in Cardillo from 1947.
Let me ask you about that case. You know, that case and the other U.S. Supreme Court cases you've cited all really involve limitations on jurisdiction. Those are cases where they're looking to see whether the state can legitimately extend its jurisdiction.
Correct.
And this is a case where we're trying to decide whether South Dakota can exercise jurisdiction, has jurisdiction to begin with. So it seems to me that there's a little bit of a disconnect with applying those limiting cases to a case where we have to decide, did the legislature enact legislation that assumes jurisdiction?
Right. And that's a good question. The reason that they're relevant is, in this case, if you look at South Dakota law, and in this Cardillo case and in the other cases I cite, the first place they look is in the Work Comp Act for jurisdiction. You look, how do they define employer? How do they define employee? And so you can see the language in those cases. They look at that question. That's the first question. And in this particular case, in Martin, if we look at the South Dakota statutes, they're very broad. Employer, any individual, firm, association using the service of another for pay. Does not say it has to be in South Dakota. Employee, same thing. Any person who is in the service of another for pay. And then there's even a separate statute which says that every employer and employee shall be presumed to have accepted the provisions of Title 62 whether the injury occurs in this state, South Dakota, or not. So our law is, I don't know how it could be more clear, that South Dakota, the South Dakota legislature, has allowed for jurisdiction in a case like this. Now, the argument on the other side is, well, that's so open-ended that you could have someone who has absolutely no connection to the state, and they can be hauled into our courts. And that, Justice Zinter, is where the constitutional, the full faith and credit analysis comes in. In these cases that I cite, they say the first question is, does the state, does the District of Columbia, or does Maine give jurisdiction? And in those cases, they did. It was very broad, just like our statutes. The next question is, does that assertion, under the facts of this particular case, where the person lived in the state or had other connections, does it violate the full faith and credit clause? And the courts have basically, for that question, it boils down to, does the state, in this case South Dakota, have a legitimate interest? And as I quoted to you before, in this Supreme Court case, they say residence is an important interest because a state wants to protect its residents who get hurt.
Mr. Simpson, in looking at the cases dealing with full faith and credit, U.S. Supreme Court cases seem to be based on the personal jurisdiction limitations. Are we talking about personal jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction? And I didn't say anything. The briefs all use the word jurisdiction, and I'm trying, this is a closed case. Which is it, personal jurisdiction or subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, I think that if it's both, really, because in every case you have to satisfy due process, that there's some connection, some minimum contact with the forum. We have that here. Colloid, you know, has a huge payroll. They have plants within the state, and she lives within the state. So that's personal, but that's not really been contested. It's subject matter jurisdiction, which is full faith and credit clause.
All right. And that the Department of Labor used the three-part Larson test in determining subject matter jurisdiction, and the trial court, or the circuit court, used statutory interpretation. And are you saying they're both dealing then with subject matter jurisdiction in their interpretation?
Well, yes, to the extent they are. What the Department of Labor did is they didn't even really address the definition of employee and employer in their decision or their findings and conclusions. They just said, well, we in the past have adopted this three-part test. The three-part test comes from a treatise which tries to compile cases and statutes from other jurisdictions. It's not actually a source of law. And my argument is that we have to look to the law. There's no ambiguity in this law such that we have to go look at Professor Larson's treatise and basically legislate that we're going to use a three-part test.
Let me ask you about that because, kind of as a cute side note, I find it interesting that now you're trashing Larson. A lot of times, you're flashing Larson. But aside from that, you know, is it really true that the legislature has spoken that clearly in this case? I mean, this statute, the definitions are so broad, it seems to me like the legislature has not spoken on the issue. Because if you take the statutes as broadly as you argue them, residency alone would be sufficient, and I don't think anybody argues that that's the test.
I think that, as an analogy, let's look at the long-arm statute for the state of South Dakota. Before the long-arm statute, we had basically a judicial test, which was the International Shoot case, which we had to meet certain notions of minimum contacts. I think that a state legislature can legitimately say, we're going to take jurisdiction of all cases to the extent that it doesn't violate the Constitution. That's what we do in the long-arm statute, and that's legitimate, and that's really what we have done in workers' comp. Why, if we're going to stand here or be in the judiciary and say, well, state legislature, you should have really written it a different way and put in a three-part test, as opposed to writing it broadly and just allowing the Constitution to limit the extent of the jurisdiction, as we do in the long-arm statute. I mean, I think that that's a matter for the legislature to, and they have spoken. The alternative is to just say to the legislature, well, we think that this three-part test, which is actually not a majority rule among courts, it's a rule that state legislatures have sometimes implemented. If you look at the colloid's brief, they don't cite any cases that deal with a case like this, where we have a broad grant of jurisdiction, like we had in the District of Columbia or in Maine, where they did limit those by constitutional standards. There's not one case cited in their brief that says, well, when you have a broad grant of authority, the courts are applying the three-part Larson test. There is no case cited, and that's because that hasn't happened. Larson is talking about this majority rule. Is state legislatures are saying we are going to put this three-part test into law. Now, if South Dakota had done that, I wouldn't be here. But they didn't. And they had the choice to do that, and the long-arm statute shows that when they want to get very specific about putting in limitations on jurisdiction, they certainly can. And it also shows that they're cognizant of the constitutional limitations. So that's my basic argument here.
One thing I struggle with is you seem to be arguing that under South Dakota law, American Colloid should be responsible for double damages because they failed to obtain workers' compensation for their Wyoming employee who's a resident of South Dakota. So not only do we have to accept that the legislature intended to have her covered under workers' compensation, we also have to accept now that the legislature intended by its statutory scheme to punish an employer who's provided workers' compensation in Wyoming by not getting it here. So they're going to pay workers' they paid for insurance there, and now they're going to pay double damages here. Can you help me get past that?
Yes. I am not claiming that they don't have insurance coverage here. They are not claiming they don't have insurance coverage here. There's never been a DEC action.
So I don't understand that your brief deals with the double damage issue. How does that come into play then?
Right. What I was saying there was Judge Barnett had this analysis where he said that essentially he didn't think that the facts showed that Colloid was insured in South Dakota. Therefore, because the statutes say that they're not bound by South Dakota law, there's no jurisdiction. I was just pointing out that under that particular statute, if you don't have insurance, you get sued for double damages. You don't say there's no jurisdiction. And in their brief, in the Colloid's brief, they say, yeah, we have insurance coverage. If you look at Exhibit 19, it's the insurance policy. It lists South Dakota. They paid a huge premium to cover all their workers throughout. I mean, this is a huge corporation. They have insurance coverage.
All right. Well, Mr. Simpson, they didn't have insurance coverage, though, and the underwriting wasn't based on Ms. Martin. In this case, she was listed as an employee in Wyoming under their rules. So there really wasn't insurance coverage that was paid for in South Dakota for her.
This case is a jurisdiction case. It's not a coverage case. They have never filed a declaratory judgment action saying there's no coverage.
But doesn't that tie into the second part of the Larson test of the place where, or the third part, one is where the one's hiring, one's where the injury occurred, and the third is where she was employed. It would be the third part of that test on where she was employed.
There is the way that Colloid insures work comp is they have a substantial presence in Belle Fourche, which is about 20 miles away from their colony plant. which is just over the border into Wyoming. And these plants are sister plants, and they do all sorts of stuff together. And they basically mine clay, and they make it into kitty litter, basically. And they bought what's called other states insurance. They bought insurance for South Dakota, and Wyoming is a state-funded plan, so they have to submit their payroll to Wyoming. They have insurance in both states, and this case, there's no evidence in this case that they do not have insurance for Vera Martin in South Dakota for this South Dakota claim. And that has never been an issue until the circuit court said there's no insurance. And then I pointed out, well, if there's no insurance, the remedy is double damages, and then there's an admission in the brief from Colloid saying, well, yeah, we have insurance in South Dakota. If they didn't, there would be other proceedings where we could get at those issues. Those issues have never been addressed here, other than there is a payroll, some information about the payroll that was submitted to Wyoming. So there is an argument here that this is going to lead to a flood of claims, that this is going to cause all sorts of problems. This is no different than the long-arm statute, where we take jurisdiction in South Dakota. Our legislature says, if there's something concerning our citizens, we want to take care of it, which is like most states do. They want to take as much jurisdiction as possible, and that's very consistent with work comp law, which is we cover everyone as much as possible. Even if the employee doesn't want to be covered, we cover them because we want them to get an adequate amount of compensation because they live in our state. Just like in the long-arm statute, this is limited by the federal constitution. So if there's any unfairness to this corporation, they can raise those issues. And I guess they have in this case by arguing that there's no jurisdiction. And we have tried to cite specific cases, one from the U.S. Supreme Court and a couple from the Supreme Court of Maine, where they have said the residence of the worker is an important interest. Plus, in this case, we have some additional factors. Colloid has a substantial presence, and she had a lot of contact with basically an HR person in Belfouche throughout the course, well, at the beginning of her employment and kind of at the end of her employment. So that's an additional contact that Colloid has with South Dakota. So it's not just residents.
Let's go to Cardillo a minute, though. You know, there was also a contract between the employee and the D.C. employer in that case. The claimant was hired in the district and had worked in the district and was sent to, was it Virginia or someplace? It was sent out of state wherever.
That's right.
The person was hurt.
Right.
So there's a lot more contact in Cardillo and in Thomas and in Shannon, too, I think, than we have here.
There's, I agree with you. In the Cardillo case, he did work in the District of Columbia in the past. But for the 3 years prior to when he got hurt, he had worked exclusively in Virginia for that employer. And the employer did have a presence in the District of Columbia. I am not saying, I don't think I am required to come with a case exactly on point, especially when there are absolutely no cases that have been cited to the contrary. There are no cases saying that residence alone is not a valid interest. None. In their case, where they have to list their issue and then they list their cases, the cases that are listed are the two Department of Labor decisions, which are not binding authority, and the Thomas case, which isn't even... Thomas is the case that where the Supreme Court said successive awards are okay. And, yeah, there were a lot more contacts in that case, but I'm not relying on that for my argument. So we've come forward with cases that say this is legitimate. This can be done. And South Dakota has an interest. And the opposing view is, well, let's bring in Professor Larson's treatise, which I agree, I do use when we have issues that are unsettled, such as In work comp, we have the phrase arising out of the employment. Nobody knows what that means when somebody's walking into work doing other things that are not right at work. So we cite Professor Larson's treatise because there's cases around the country that interpret an ambiguity. I don't think there's an ambiguity here.
Where does this three-part test come from? Is it purely a creation of Professor Larson, or does it come from a case, or is it... You mentioned in your brief several times that this is a statutory formulation.
Right, and I have 6 seconds.
Well, go ahead and answer.
Okay. There was a commission in 1972 done by President Nixon called the National Commission on Workers' Compensation Laws. One of the 19 recommendations was this three-part test, all right? So a lot of states have adopted that since that time. And I think that Larson is talking about that, is
all right.
Explaining that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. McNally?
May it please the court, counsel. The issue before this court today is whether the appellant's South Dakota worker compensation claim was properly dismissed for lack of jurisdiction when the appellant's place of injury, her place of hire, and the place of her employment relationship did not occur within the state of South Dakota. I would submit to you that the answer to this question is yes for three reasons. First, the South Dakota Department of Labor adopted a very sensible test that is utilized by the majority of states that we've had discussion on in the prior argument to find that appellant's claim lacked jurisdiction. Secondly, the adoption of appellant's interpretation of South Dakota statutes and its supposed relationship to jurisdiction would lead to an absurd result far beyond the intentions of the South Dakota legislature. And third, supplemental worker compensation awards are permitted, but only after jurisdiction is found. First, we go to the fact that the South Dakota Department of Labor adopted this sensible three-part test to determine jurisdiction. Title 62 of the South Dakota Code gives the Department of Labor the ability to enforce and carry out the provision of the workers' compensation statutes. In utilizing and determining jurisdiction in 1990, the Department of Labor adopted Larson's three-part test. The factors in the three-part test are very simple. We look to the place of injury, we look to the place of hire, and we look to where the place of the employment relationship exists. Now, the South Dakota Department of Labor noted in its lower decision that this is similar to the significant relationship test that's adopted by this court. The department also noted that since 1978, the majority of states have adopted this three-part test to be used to determine jurisdiction.
By statute, right?
Yes.
By statute.
Yes.
I guess what I'm struggling is why would we want to adopt another jurisdiction statute in order to resolve a jurisdiction issue in South Dakota?
Well, Justice Konenkamp, we don't have to adopt another statute from another state. This three-part test is already being utilized by the South Dakota Department of Labor. And basically what we're asking this court to do is inform the...
We're endorsing it, then. We're endorsing another state statute that our Department of Labor has adopted. But I guess my question is are there any case authority? Usually we rely upon case authority from other states, too, and we decide then whether that's appropriate. But rarely maybe never have we taken another state statute and said, okay, we're going to apply that statute now. And I guess is there some case authority besides a state statute?
Well, I guess, Your Honor, we're not specifically saying we're going to take the state of Colorado statute and apply it here in this case. This has been outlined in Larson's treatise with regard to, and it has been codified in some states, but it's also been utilized in the way that it's used in South Dakota. And what the commission, as the appellant was even referring to, talked about is that most states utilize this test. So it's not necessarily that we're directly adopting someone else's statute. We're taking this body of authority that's being utilized sensibly by a majority of the states because it's a very clear test. It's simple. And when we apply this test to the case of appellant in this matter, we clearly find there's no jurisdiction. First, the place of injury in this case was in Wyoming. There's no dispute to that. Second, the place of hiring was in Wyoming. Appellant was interviewed in Wyoming. Her application was processed in Wyoming, and she started work in Wyoming. Her wages were determined in Wyoming. And third, her place of employment relationship was clearly in Wyoming. Now, Professor Larson expands upon this place of employment relationship test, and he tells us what we need to do is look at the origin of where the employment relationship starts. And then only then, that's where a relationship is, and it only changes when it's so clear that the relationship has shifted and become fixed in another state. In this case, there's no dispute that the appellant never worked in the state of South Dakota. She clearly only worked in the state of Wyoming. That's where her place of relationship was clearly fixed. It never left Wyoming. Anything that happened after the injury is kind of minor and tangential, frankly. And so, therefore, in this case, we meet all three prongs, and there is no jurisdiction for appellant's claim. Now, Larson goes on further to talk about, because appellant will make a lot about these incidental contacts with the Balfouche office, for instance. But Larson tells us we don't question whether each of the parties had some type of independent contact with another state or another forum. We look at the parties' relationship themselves, the employer and the employee. And clearly that relationship was within the state of Wyoming. Now, we also need to look at the appellant herself knew she was availing herself of the Wyoming jurisdiction. She knew she was going to work in Wyoming, and she traveled. And so she knew that all that was happening.
Let me interrupt just for a minute, because I don't really hear Mr. Simpson arguing application of the three-part test. I mean, his argument is we shouldn't adopt the test. Back to Justice Kohlenkamp's question. Do you have a feel or know what the headcount is among the states that apply it? How many are statutory and how many have adopted it as a matter of common law?
I don't have an exact number for you, Justice Hunter.
But there is a clear demarcation there.
Between whether
when you read all these cases, is it pretty evident the ones that have statutory basis and those that do not? I'm looking for a case that doesn't have a statutory basis for the test.
I can't point you to one specifically right at the moment, Justice Hunter. What I can tell you is that the majority of states use it, whether it be codified or whether they just use it in applications such as our Department of Labor. I do want to point out that appellant argued in his oral argument today that we have not cited any cases that say residence alone is not sufficient to grant jurisdiction over a workers' compensation claim. That is an error. Matter of fact, the Department of Labor in the Myers case has stated residence alone is not enough for jurisdiction. And actually, what's true is the opposite. The appellant has never cited any case that says residence alone is enough to invoke jurisdiction. In matter of fact, when we look at some of those cases, the Cardillo case and the Shannon case and the Dissel case, which I'll get into a little bit later, those, in fact, don't even say residence alone is enough to establish jurisdiction. Going to my second point, adoption of appellant's interpretation of the South Dakota statutes and its supposed relationship to jurisdiction leads to an absurd result far beyond the intention of the South Dakota legislature. It's logical to assume that when the legislature enacted Title 62, it was doing it with keeping in mind that it was enacting it for South Dakota employees. It was not looking to provide coverage for other employees.
Can I ask pretty much the same question I asked Mr. Simpson? Both of you talk about jurisdiction, and you slip back and forth between tests for personal jurisdiction and for subject matter jurisdiction. Which are you talking about? Because you were talking about cases that dealt with personal jurisdiction and contacts, and now you're talking about what was intended to be covered. What test, and it makes a difference in what tests we apply. What kind of jurisdiction are you talking about?
I think we're talking about subject matter jurisdiction. Justice Severson. I think that's where we're at. I think that has to be ascertained, and then whether there's personal jurisdiction is something else. But I think the central issue is centered around subject matter jurisdiction in this case. The way that the appellant argues...
Then why wouldn't the workers' compensation, why wouldn't we be bound then to find out whether there's subject matter jurisdiction based on just the workers' compensation laws, which she fits under employee, the definition of employee, and the employer admittedly has participated in South Dakota's workers' compensation program. So why wouldn't there be subject matter jurisdiction?
Well, Your Honor, because I don't believe that the South Dakota legislature made the definitions of employer and employee to confer jurisdiction. I think the reason that those definitions were provided were so that employers couldn't shirk the responsibility of who actually constitutes an employee so as that not to cover them if they became injured. I mean, I can really think that's what the intent of the legislature was.
Isn't it also the intent, though, to protect the residents of the state? To make sure that if they're injured, a work-related incident is covered by workers' compensation.
Well, nowhere in the statute does it say a South Dakota resident, first of all, Justice Meyer Henry. And secondly, every state has a workers' compensation system. So even if you're a resident of South Dakota and you go to work, as the appellant did, in the state of Wyoming, she's covered. She's covered by the state of Wyoming's workers' compensation statutes. I think if we allowed this broad... this truly broad definition of employer-employee, we go somewhere way beyond where the South Dakota legislature intended. For instance, by allowing that, and the appellant states directly in their brief that South Dakota doesn't require any employer to be located in the state by that definition, and the state it doesn't require that any employment be performed in the state. So now what happens is if this court actually adopts that interpretation of those statutes and say that that somehow confers the jurisdiction, any employee of any multi-state company that has some kind of location in South Dakota would be allowed to file a workers' compensation claim in the state of South Dakota, whether or not they've ever even set foot in the state of South Dakota. So to adopt that interpretation would just open the floodgates of workers' compensation claims, and it's clearly beyond the logical, sensible intent of Title 62. Now, what also would happen if we allow this broad interpretation is employers and insurers alike are going to have problem with just everyday business planning. For instance, if you have a multi-state company who has a location in South Dakota and elsewhere, how are they ever to know, how are they ever to fixate premiums on which employees? Because there would be no ascertainable reality as to which employees would file in the state of South Dakota and which wouldn't. That's why the Larson's test is clearly the sensible approach. It's easy, and it's logical.
Well, it would be limited in this case to a resident of South Dakota, correct?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understand
your
question.
Well, your question was, or your comment was that how would we know where they would apply? Well, they would know depending upon the residence of the employee.
Well, I don't
in
think...
In this case, I mean, that's what is the connection to South Dakota.
Well, I think that's what the appellant is arguing, is that her mere residence alone would give her jurisdiction. But, I mean, if you look at the test for jurisdiction, Wyoming would also have jurisdiction over this claim if that were true. Because she was injured in Wyoming, she was working in Wyoming. And appellants themselves have never cited any authority that says residence alone is enough to invoke jurisdiction in a workers' compensation case. And so I think that's if you're buying into the appellant's argument, then you'd say, well, they would just know that if she's a South Dakota resident, she's going to apply for work comp here. That's not necessarily true, even if you did buy into that definition. I was listening to the first oral argument with DeSmet, and I think it was Justice Koenigkamp brought up the point about how would DeSmet know to calculate their premiums if there's this unknown. And I think that's what would happen in this case is you would have insurers and employers alike who in a lot of cases self-insure to a certain limit before the insurance company takes over. There would be a lot of unknowns about what would actually be paid out and who would be paid out to. I want to also go to the fact that the three cases that that the appellant cites in their brief, none of these cases rest on the statutory definition of an employer and employee. If we look at the Cardillo case, 1947 U.S. Supreme Court case, and I think there was some talk about it between Justice Zinter and appellant's counsel, but this was an employee who was hired in the District of Columbia. He had an employee-employment relationship in the District of Columbia, but he had worked and he had an injury in Virginia. Now, the court even says the key to their decision was the substantial connection between the District of Columbia and the particular employer-employee relationship. That's what the court said was the key, not the definitions of what an employee is or what an employer is. And so, and then there was also the geographical boundaries that kind of played in that case, that basically you drive so many miles out of D.C. and you're automatically in another state. But these cases don't say that residency alone is enough to invoke jurisdiction. If you look at the Shannon case, this is a Maine case that was brought about in 1973. The person was hired in Maine. They had an employee-employer relationship in Maine, and they were injured in an auto accident in Thailand. There was even some talk about the fact that this person, if he had not been injured, would have been going to work in D.C. And there were some assertions by one of the parties that, well, there's a substantial presence in D.C. of this company. That's where its biggest presence was, and that's where the work comp claim should have been adjudicated. And in that court, the court said, no, we look to what the significance of the work relationship was at the time of the injury. Clearly, in this case, the significance of the work relationship at the time of the injury was in Wyoming. And in all reality, if you applied the Larson's test to Cadiro and Shannon, you come up with the same result that those courts did by just utilizing the same test. The Dissel case that's cited, I just think it's not analogous enough to even for the appellant to even cite. First of all, in that case, the court stated that no state had any significant interest. We have a flight attendant who was in flight. It's not sure where her injury was. She was hired in one state, but she had been transported to many different states. And so all I have to say on that is just that, that I don't really think that case applies or is analogous enough to this situation for the court to really consider it. I guess I also want to point out that if the statute is so clear, as the appellant has asserted, why are we looking to the Maine Supreme Court to determine how to interpret that? On one hand, the appellant's arguing it's clear. On the other hand, he's saying, but look at these cases and how they interpreted it at that. Lastly, supplemental workers' compensation claims are only permitted when they could have been brought in that second state in the first instance. What the Thomas case clearly says is that if the claimant could have brought the workers' compensation claim in the second state to begin with, there is no problem with the full faith and credit clause, and therefore supplemental award can be granted. However, it's very clear that you first have to meet that prong of jurisdiction. You just automatically get a supplemental award. In conclusion, unless I have some other questions, appellees would ask this court to affirm the decisions of the South Dakota Department of Labor and the Circuit Court and find that dismissal of appellant South Dakota claim was proper and that this claim lacked jurisdiction in the state of South Dakota. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Simpson.
There was a question by Justice Zinter about what percentage of the states have adopted the Larson test. Did they do so by statute? And I think it's telling, as I said before, there are no cases cited by Colloid. If there were states out there that had not adopted Larson by statute, but had done so by its judiciary to fill some sort of a gap that they felt was present in the statute, I'm sure they would have been cited. The reality is that report, that national commission that was done in 1972, They send out updates, and you can look it up if you want. They tell you how many states have adopted that particular recommendation. It is a recommendation for state legislators to adopt this. It's not a recommendation for Supreme Courts around the country to adopt this. This idea that this is going to open the floodgates because we're going to have all these people that are not from South Dakota filing claims really misses half of the argument here. The first half of the argument is, has South Dakota asserted jurisdiction? Yes, they have. The language is very clear, and your case law over and over again says when the statute's clear, it's not our job to figure out if it's a good idea or not. It's to follow the statute. And then the next part of this court's obligation is to make sure, because they've objected to subject matter jurisdiction, is to make sure that in this case, where the claimant lives here and there are these connections and there's a substantial presence in South Dakota, is the Constitution violated? Is the full faith and credit clause violated by bringing them into South Dakota? And that is where we're not going to have people from other states coming in. We're going to have people like Vera Martin, who live in South Dakota, who applied in South Dakota, who, when she was dealing with her doctors, dealt with the HR person at the Belfouche office in South Dakota, and who did work in Wyoming, but that company is right on the border with South Dakota and has a lot of contact with another office that's right across the border.
How significant is that? You've mentioned 2-3 times, 10 miles, 20 miles. What about if it's 250 miles?
Well,
does that make a difference in your argument?
I think it not a lot, but a little bit, because there's this assertion made that what we're trying to do is it's residents only. Just because she lives here, she's trying to bring this claim. And it's not just residents only. It's residents plus she has all these connections with the Belfouche office, which is about 22 miles from this other office, and I took some depositions and of these employees, and they say we have a thing called intercompany mail, where they basically have runners go back and forth between the two facilities. The heads of the facilities talk because they do the same thing. She was scheduled, after she got hurt, to have a light-duty job at the Belfouche office. She actually received training in the Belfouche office for a week. That's in the record. That's not disputed by them. So it's not just that she lives here. It's that she has a connection with a company that is really quite connected to South Dakota. They have an office here, and the office that she worked in, Justice Miller, is very close, and she had a lot of connections with Belfouche. That's why I bring it up.
Thank you.
One other thing, this question of are there other states out there that are doing something different? I think this is in the record, the original motion that was filed by Colloid. If you look at that and the cases that were cited there, they did cite two cases from other jurisdictions. They cited an Arizona case and they cited an Iowa case. And then when I actually read the cases, it turned out that in each of those cases, the Iowa legislature and the Arizona legislature had, by statute, adopted some version of the Larson test, which prohibited the claim from going forward because it was based on residency. So, and then those cases have not followed through and are not in briefing since that time. And what that tells me, and what that should tell us is, a search has been made. There are no cases out there where courts have done what Colloid is asking. It may be a sensible test. It may be a great idea, but the South Dakota legislature hasn't adopted it, and this claimant is entitled to her day in court in South Dakota under the plain terms of this South Dakota statute as limited by the U.S. Constitution. I have additional time if there are any questions. Otherwise, I'm going to stop.
Any further questions? I guess not. Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will be in recess until 9 a.m. tomorrow morning.